You just heard music from Rahsaan Roland Kirk here on KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot. From 1969's Volunteered Slavery, you heard the title track from that album. Rahsaan Roland Kirk is the subject of a brand new documentary film called The Case of the Three-Sided Dream. And it's our pleasure to welcome into our studios the filmmaker responsible for this film, Adam Khan. How are you doing, Adam?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Thank you for coming in. As we were talking before, actually started recording this, a film on Rahsaan is something that I've dreamed about for a good 20 years, I think, ever since actually coming into contact with his music. And there have been a few more kind of concert films over the years that have come out so that people can actually see Rahsaan. But until this moment with your film, there hasn't really been something that tells the story in this kind of way, a way that it certainly deserved for a long time. So really thankful for you being here and also especially for making this film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my pleasure. And you said mentioned 20 years. It's been almost that long to make. I started it quite a while ago, and then it kind of got stalled for lack of funding, and then it was dormant for several years. But about 3 years ago, I picked it back up and finished it. But and also, as you said, you know, there's stuff of him on the internet all over, but there's nothing that kind of tells the story A to Z. And the beautiful thing about the film is we have access to Dorothon Kirk, to Rory Kirk, to Ron Burton, who played with him for 20 years, and all these guys and gals, people who knew him intimately. So it's an intimate film.
So one place to start, I think, would be how you actually found the music of Rahsaan Roland Kirk, how you got introduced to it. Before we even get to how the film and all that stuff started, I'm just interested in how you actually got brought into his music.
Yeah, and it all makes sense with the film, really, because the way I got into his music is I took a chance. You know, I was looking for records at a garage sale, and at that point I wasn't into jazz. I was like, oh, maybe I should try and get into jazz. And I picked up one of his albums at a garage sale, and it didn't even have a picture of him playing. As you know, he played three saxophones simultaneously and did all this wild stuff. It was just a headshot. It was like an Atlantic Records comp. So I visually, there was no indication of what I was getting into. But, you know, it was Love at First Listen, that record. And then, you know, I became a fan for several years. But, and also, as I'm sure you know, his life story is so, like, absurdly extraordinary and amazing. So the more liner notes I read over the years, you know, I was like, okay, great music and incredible, like, literally, in the literal sense of the term, incredible life story.
Yeah. And so I would imagine that you were a filmmaker or had been studying to be a filmmaker that entire period of time when you were introduced to his music and started to learn more about him. How did the idea to do a film on Roland Kirk start?
Yeah. I mean, right around the time I was buying that record at a garage sale in San Francisco, I was really learning filmmaking, and this is 1989.
Okay.
I had my first Super 8 film camera when people bought those things, made little short films, graduated to 16mm Bolex. And so, yeah, I was kind of making films mostly for my own amusement, but for a while. And then I did end up making some docs. But, you know, again, going back to his life story, reading the liner notes, I was talking with a friend of mine in New York one day. I had just moved back to New York. And I said, you know, Rahsaan did this and this, that, and, you know, we'll get into that. And I said, someone should make a film about him. And my friend was like, well, you should make that film. And then, you know, this was 1999. Again, I started it and stopped. But there were phone books back in those days. And I called up his old producer, Joel Dorn, just from the phone book. And the guy was super accessible. And he opened a ton of doors for me. And the thing just snowballed from there.
Wow. Yeah, it's I wonder, do you even think, like, if you had come up with the idea here in 2014, do you think it would have been as easy to kind of get the ball rolling and get across people?
Well, yes and no. I mean, what's easier now is all the footage. You know, back when I started, the internet was very young, and all that footage of him playing, and there exists a ton, as you know, of concerts all over the world. That was really hard to get my hands on back then. Every time I got my hands on a piece of footage, I would get a VHS tape sent to me as a screener. You know, it was like gold. And now, you know, there's so much stuff, so much more stuff accessible. So in that respect, it was harder in the beginning. But now, you know, now also there's crowdfunding that helps a little, like with Kickstarter and things like that. I don't, you know, some things are easier now, some things are harder. But the people, you know, the hardest thing was getting the trust of the people, of Dorothon.
That's what I would imagine.
Yeah. And Rory and Joel Dorn, his former producer, who unfortunately is not in the film, but helped me with the early goings of the film. But, you know, just kind of being honest and having integrity and working with them over the years, they opened up to me and opened doors and helped me make it possible.
How if you could say a little bit about that process, just because it is in some respects it's a situation where you're coming in as an outsider. It's not that you're really well known among jazz circles or musician circles. You don't really seem or filmmaking circles. It's like you don't really seem to have a lot of social capital networks you know, to draw on. And yet you had, you know, this really nicely, you know, ability to get a hold of Joel Dorn and then kind of snowball from there. I just wonder a little bit about that process, like how you were able to, as your contacts started to increase, how you were able to kind of, you know, let them know that this was something that you were really passionate about and that you really wanted to see this through.
Yeah, well, we, you know, from day one to now, there was definitely a long road. And when we started, I mean, a few things. As you know a lot about Rahsaan, as I do, of course, you know, all along the way, I'm like, why isn't, like, Clint Eastwood making a movie about him or Spike Lee or, you know, one of those big guys, which, by the way, I would love for them to executive produce a biopic that Dorothon and I want to make, but we can get to that.
Yeah.
But, I was like, you know, he's such an incredible subject. It's like, why isn't someone with that kind of social filmmaking or musical capital already hip to this and making it? Now, that's still a mystery to me, but... But glad they didn't, and I was able to do it. But, you know, in the beginnings, we shot really kind of down and dirty interviews. So I think for people like Joel Dorn, like Dorothon Kirk, like Rory Kirk, like Edith Kirk, and all those, and the musician Steve Touré, it didn't cost them a lot. Not literally cost them, but, you know, it wasn't a big investment for them to say, okay, I'll give you an hour interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were testing the waters in the beginning. I mean, I did several interviews with a lot of them. And, you know, the first interviews were kind of like Rahsaan 101. So they kind of gave me the pat answers, and it was all very nice. But as the years progressed and multiple interviews, then, you know, the trust grew and we could get deeper. So it was over time that it really kind of grew.
Now, this film is it's not a short film. It's a feature-length doc, I think, like close to 90 minutes.
Yeah, 87 minutes.
And there's a possibility of talking about a variety of different aspects of his life, and he lived a very full life. Mm-hmm. A lot of different things were going on with Rahsaan Roland Kirk. Could you talk a little bit about just about Rahsaan?
Yeah,
you know, there's a fair amount. I would imagine, especially listeners of my show, there's a really fair amount of people who know his music, but he isn't as well known and, you know, hasn't been embraced in quite the same way that other people of that era have been. And so not everybody knows about Rahsaan. So could you say a little bit about Rahsaan himself?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's good to get an overview on him. And I think the reason why he's not, you know, I wrestle with this, as does his family and all the guys who know him and played with him. You know, why is he not better known? But I think it's because, like you said, he did so many things. He was so kind of expansive. You know, Miles Davis, cool jazz trumpet, got it. Charlie Parker bebop, got it. Armstrong, et cetera. But Rahsaan, not to dismiss those guys, they're heavy hitters, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Rahsaan did... There's so many facets to him. It's musically... He did so many things musically. He could have just been a virtuoso on the tenor, but he decided to play three saxophones, which a vision came to him in his dreams that told him to play three saxophones. So he did it. He just went out and did it. You know, he was an experimenter. He'd play flute out of his nose. He'd play whistles and bells and gongs. And we can get into that component too. But then it would also be reductive to just call it a music doc, or to say Rassan's story is just about music, because he was made blind at the age of two, and he wrestled with a lot of kind of disability issues, treatment of people with disabilities. He was African American in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Mm-hmm. He dealt with some heavy race issues. He was an activist. He started a political movement. And then, you know, if that all isn't enough, he had a stroke at the end of his life, became half paralyzed, but then just kept playing with only one hand, literally till the day he died. And again, you know, you asked me why, what was the idea to make the film? I mean, given all that, it's just, you know, how much better content can anyone get? You can't get better than that. You can't make that stuff up.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost, you know, and I've wondered about this in the past too, like why more people don't know his music. Because I feel like every single person who I've either played music, Rassan's music for, or, you know, like everybody who's heard his music is a massive fan of Rassan Roller
yeah.
Kirk. And I think that it's almost as if there's too much to Rassan.
I think, you know? So, yeah.
Like there's just too many facets, and some of it
totally.
I think connects in his playing, but, you know, just in the life story. I mean, when you think about other kind of giants of not just jazz, but any kind of popular in the strict sense, popular music, you know, it's a little bit easier in some respects, it seems, to kind of tell their narrative. But Rassan's story and his life is so big, and his music, the musical palette is so expansive that it seems like that in itself might have been a real challenge in making a movie about Rassan. You know, like how do you decide? How can you fit it all in? You know,
I mean, there were certain things. I mean, it's a big legacy, as you basically are saying.
Yeah,
and you know, I'm still like, God, did I get it right? There's so much to get right. There's so much to include. So I was definitely kind of felt some pressure about getting it right, getting in all the important things, the things, you know, about race, about disabilities, about the music, and all the varying components of the music. I mean, I actually didn't get in as much about the music as I would like, though there is a ton of music in it. I mean, one of the things I decided from the onset was like, this is not going to be a kind of talking head documentary. Mm. We go to a 10-second clip of a song, and then we cut out. You know, this is about Rassan. He's a musician. You're going to see Rassan. So there is a lot of music. And the other thing you mentioned, which I thought was right on, is, you know, you play Rassan, and people do. They almost always love it. I mean, he's immediately, how can I say, you're immediately engaged.
Mm.
You look at Rassan and you see the three saxophones, and also he dressed really funky and he made instruments with tape and you know, he's an eyeful, which again is ironic. I mean, he's a blind guy, but the documentary visually is quite stunning just looking at him.
Mm.
But you see all that and you think, this guy's an avant-garde, wacky, maybe you can say he was wacky, whatever, and you can say he's avant-garde, but... And therefore, I think a lot of people would dismiss him as such, but I think his music, and I'm wondering, I think you'll agree, his music is so accessible. It's not, I mean, I don't think it's avant-garde. I think it's based in the blues. It's based in tradition. He really knew Armstrong, Ellington, played a lot of Ellington, and a lot of just blues and spirituals. And, you know, he did a lot of soul jazz stuff. He played, you know, My Girl, Bill Withers. He played... And I think his music at the end of the day is super accessible. But, you know, if you don't, if you kind of just look at him and say, oh, I don't like jazz, or, oh, he's a weirdo, which I think a lot of people might do, then you're going to miss it.
Yeah. I in some respects, there's a part of me that feels like Rassan was in some ways more avant-garde than a lot of the people that we talk about, especially from the free jazz movement around that same period of time when he was kind of coming up, early 60s into the 70s. There's a lot of people that we associate, you know, with being trailblazers of that avant-garde jazz.
Right.
But Rassan's ability to mix together elements from the past and the present and in some ways kind of
future.
The future,
absolutely.
Into a way that even when there are elements that are very clearly kind of out there, the kind of thing that brings you in, as opposed to what happens often with people who are not kind of prepared for avant-garde music. It just kind of goes over their head, or it just sounds like noise to them. And there's never a moment that I can think of where it seems like Rassan isn't making sounds for the purpose of having people like dig those sounds.
Absolutely. I think he was all about engagement, engaging his audience. And you know, a lot of times he was criticized because he was called, quote unquote, an entertainer. I mean, we can also get into the kind of gimmick stuff people criticized him about, which is inaccurate. But, you know, he was conscious about being, about entertaining people, about putting on a show. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, he wanted to engage the audience, and he really did. And as you know, he talked a lot too on stage.
Yeah, he had great sense of humor on stage as well.
Yeah,
from the live recordings that I've seen.
And you'll see it in the film as well. I mean, again, in making the film, it's a film about Rassan. So though we have great interviews with people from his world, it's mostly Rassan talking and playing. And another thing, Dorthon Kirk, his wife, his third wife, because he was briefly married at a very young age, and he was married to Edith Kirk for a while, who was very helpful in making of this film too, though she's not in it. Dorthon Kirk is kind of the keeper of the mantle at this point, his soulmate, if you will. But she laid on me a bunch of Super 8 home movies.
Mm.
So you get to see a lot of that in the film, and it really lends an intimacy. And it's really, again, that stuff you're not going to see anywhere. And it's beautiful stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the many things from the descriptions of the film that I'm especially excited to see. Just for a moment to talk about that issue of the kind of gimmickiness of Rassan, it kind of connects back to some of the things that we were talking about earlier, and the kind of frustration that fans of Rassan have that, you know, he isn't more well known or he isn't more highly regarded. I think it would seem like a lot of that has to connect to the sense that people looked at him as a gimmick, like the people who didn't get Rassan, they looked at him that way.
Absolutely.
And so I wonder if, you know, just if you could say a bit about that and what I would imagine the film helps to dispel about that notion.
Yeah, we talk about it in the film, but, you know, there was, again, it's a double-edged sword, as everything is with Rassan, because most critics got it. And, you know, in the Downbeat polls and the Musician polls, he was always one of accolades and readers' polls and critics' polls. But, you know, there were people who dismissed him as a gimmick because, you know, first of all, you see a guy playing three saxophones and you just can't – does not compute, you know. It's like, what the hell is he trying to do?
Yeah.
But, you know, and that infuriated him. But he was – again, he was explorative. He wanted to try anything he could to get his musical message across. He used his nose. As you know, he played the nose flute, which was a hose kind of taped onto a flute that went right up his nose.
Yeah.
But you
and sometimes the nose flute and the kind of traditional flute at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah. And he, you know, he music was his thing, sound was his thing, and he was an explorer, and he just felt, as he says in the film, you know, I feel like the nose is there and it's making air, so why not use it? And as one of the other guys in the film says, it wasn't just that he was circular breathing or playing three saxophones or flute out his nose, but he was conveying stuff. He was playing like real music, and he was, you know, it was what he was doing. Those were just other methods for him to get his music across, and it was all good. It wasn't just like, look at me, I'm playing three horns. It was like, listen, this is, I'm harmonizing with myself. I'm playing a Duke Ellington tune, a whole horn section in one mouth.
Yeah. There is actually a clip we were going to play. Might as well play it right now, especially since you were talking about Rassan's ability to do circular breathing. And it's a clip from the film featuring the trombonist Steve Turre, and kind of talking about his experience playing with Rassan in the Vibration Society, and also specifically about kind of circular breathing. And he talks about it not simply as a technique, but he talks about it more as a way of connecting to the music. But you're going to hear that right now. We're just going to go ahead and play you this relatively short clip from the film, this film on Rassan Roland Kirk, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream. This is trombonist Steve Turre, who is interviewed in the film discussing Rassan and also the issue of circular breathing.
I'll tell you one experience I had. there was this song we used to play, Down by the Riverside. And he built it up and he built it up and he built it up. And then at the end of it, he'd hold this note for a long time. And while he's holding it, the drum would be going off and Hilton would be going crazy and stuff. And he would circular breathe, of course. And I could circular breathe, so I'd do it too. But one time somehow I got my rhythm messed up with the breathing, and I stopped and I took a breath and I came back in again, and he reached over and took the horn down, and then and he kept playing and finished the song, and then afterwards he said, "Once you're out, you're out. You can't come back in like that." I said, "Oh, okay." So the next night we played a song. And for some reason the lighting was a little different that night. And I started breathing. And I really listened to him. And I could hear his breathing. And I put my breathing in sync with his, and all of a sudden, man, I must have held that note 10 minutes and I didn't feel a thing, and I could feel his aura come out and cover me too, and I could feel his energy. He pulled me inside his energy, and then we were both breathing at the same time, and I was aware of it, but I wasn't in control of it. It was really kind of, I won't say creepy, it was beautiful, but it was deep. It wasn't something that you learn in a school, you know. It's not academic. It was some other stuff. And a lot of moments like that happened.
You just heard Steve Turry, the trombonist and composer, speaking about Rahsaan Roland Kirk and about the technique of circular breathing. It's a technique that allows a musician to essentially continuously play as opposed to, you know, taking a full breath, stopping, taking a breath, that kind of thing. And Rahsaan was a master of it. You know, I guess there have been a few acknowledged masters, especially since the 1970s, of this kind of circular breathing technique. But the thing that I thought was really amazing about this particular quote, Adam, is how Turi doesn't just talk about it in terms of a musical technique and kind of the virtuosity of Rahsaan Roland Kirk, that Turi's ability to really master circular breathing was more about being able to connect to Rahsaan, yes, on kind of like a very different level, not simply on how you play music, but kind of the way music moves you.
Yeah, again, and it's the way Rahsaan connected, I mean, with not only his with both his audiences and certainly his musicians and Steve. I mean, he was all about engagement and connecting with people. And you know, also a lot of band leaders, generally band leaders have reputations, you know, some are tyrants, some are known as good guys, bad guys. And, you know, Duke Ellington has his reputation, as do others. But, you know, Rahsaan was... Everybody just hands down loved, like as a band leader, he was just loved. He was so, so loved. I can't get that across more. And I think the film brings it through. But these guys, you know, what Steve was saying, they did. They connected in such a deep and meaningful way. And it comes across in the film, hopefully.
Now, with this film, one of the many things about this film that I'm really excited to see is some of the footage that we've kind of known about it, especially those of us who've been really big fans of Rahsaan Roland Kirk. But those of us who came into his music either towards the end of his career or after he had already passed, for a long period of time, there wasn't really a lot of things that were available of him performing. But there's one particular performance that is featured in the film that I don't think has really been widely or not even widely available, other than the original broadcast. And it certainly connects to the things that we were talking about with Rahsaan trying to connect to audiences and relates to kind of his activism in trying to bring more of jazz music out to the masses. And that's the performance that came out of some of that activism on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of the circumstances before the performance and kind of the performance as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a it's a great moment in the film because, you know, you think of the Ed Sullivan Show, you think of the Beatles and Teeny Bopper Screaming and whatever, you know, all the other kind of popular music he had. And to think of Rahsaan on the Ed Sullivan Show is it's kind of weird. And especially when you see it, I don't mind us, you know, kind of spoiling, giving out a spoiler here, because it's not. You got to see the footage. And the reaction on Ed Sullivan's face after they play is, like, priceless. He doesn't know what to think. But so Rahsaan was on the Ed Sullivan Show as a result of something he started called the Jazz and People's Movement. And that was a political movement, him and a bunch of other jazz musicians, but he really was the kind of driving force, along with other guys like Lee Morgan, Andrew Cyrille, Billy Harper, and some other musicians were into it. But, you know, they all agreed that there wasn't enough jazz music on national television, and there wasn't enough African-American musicians. I mean, there were a few odd guys on TV. I know Ray Brown was in, I think, Merv Griffin's band at some point. But, you know, the consensus was this was a great music, jazz, great legacy, African-American legacy, and there's no one on TV. There's, you know, there's lots of pop music to sell records and get teeny boppers excited, but the deep intellectual cultural legacy stuff wasn't being represented. So Rahsaan and he started this movement, the Jazz and People's Movement. And what they did is they would buy tickets to tapings of shows like Merv Griffin or Dick Cavett talk shows, and they would get about, you know, a dozen or so of them, maybe more. They'd get tickets, they'd get sit in the audience, they'd smuggle in small instruments, noisemakers, bells, whistles, pocket trumpets. And on a signal from Rahsaan, remember this is a blind guy leading the whole thing, they would, on a signal from Rahsaan, they would get up and stop the show. They would make noise so the show couldn't tape. And then the studios would be like, what's going on? You know, what's happening? And that would lead to a dialogue. Why are these people here? Well, then they got the dialogue. That, of course, wouldn't be on camera because they'd stop the cameras. But you know, it made the studios sit up and take notice. They were also losing money by these disruptions. You know, they had to rebook guests and all. So they really took notice. You know, the almighty dollar. They don't want to lose money. So they kind of got hip to jazz and Rahsaan's cause. And you know, it wasn't just about Rahsaan. It was he brought in tons of musicians. So subsequently, he started getting booked on TV shows. And one of the big, the kind of culmination of this was the Ed Sullivan appearance. And so for that show, he brought on an all-star band. And, you know, he also had his journeyman musicians. Again, it wasn't just about Rahsaan. It wasn't like a publicity thing for him. And there were some jealousies going on there. But, you know, he said no. He was also a historian, as you know. He knew the history. So he said, I'm going to handpick this band. And the thing I love about – one of the things I love about the performance is he handpicked this band. He was really about educating people too. So he gets an impressionist avant-garde saxophonist. He brings on Archie Shepp as one of the saxophonists along with him, who's, you know, like a painter on the saxophone. Then he gets, you know, a bebop legend, Roy Haynes, on drums, Charlie Parker's drummer. So you got representation from bebop. You have representation from the avant-garde. Then he has Mingus on bass, who's, you know, compositionally kind of the Duke Ellington inheritor.
Yeah.
And his own. So he's bringing musicians from varied parts of jazz to make this just incredible band. Plus his own band is up there. And the thing is, the Ed Sullivan Show, Rahsaan also did some really nice accessible soul jazz, as you know. Mm-hmm. So they said, yeah, well, we like, you know, your version of My Sharia Moore, the Stevie Wonder tune. And they're like, we want you to play that. We think our audience will dig that. So he was like, yeah, sure. Of course, he didn't play that. I won't tell, you know, you have to see the clip. But it's not in the documentary. I just didn't find a way to edit it in. But one of the guys who was there was saying, like, before the show, Rahsaan was backstage saying, we're going to burn it down. We're going to burn this down. and they basically got on there, and they didn't play a nice soul jazz number. They played something like In Your Face. And it's a hell of a clip to see. And again, Ed Sullivan's reaction is just like, what, you know?
Yeah. It again highlights just the many different facets of Rahsaan, not only the musician, but Rahsaan, the man, the individual.
You know, the other thing about that performance that's kind of intriguing to me is Rahsaan had a lot of obstacles in his life, always the blindness, race issues, being dismissed as a gimmick by some. So as Joel Dorn, his producer, had said many times, you know, if there weren't enough obstacles, and he would just knock them all down. No obstacle could stand in his way. So Joel Dorn would always say, you know, if there weren't enough obstacles, he would just create some. So, you know, a lot of guys feel like he did that in the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, he could have been really accessible to people by playing something soft and mellow and accessible, and he could have maybe drawn in a lot of more listeners. But, you know, he went out there and he just played like some in-your-face. He plays Mingus's Haitian Fight song.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only that, it's like they are in your face. I mean, Rahsaan presents it. He's like, he's just a badass, if we can say that.
Yeah.
I mean, he was. So, you know, he might have, it's an opportunity that maybe he, I don't know, maybe he, it's something to really think about. Did he blow it by not playing something more accessible and drawing in more viewers? Or you know, he probably couldn't have done it otherwise. He wanted to play something that was really deep and would educate people and showcase parts of jazz that people didn't know. So,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, but it's interesting and to think about, you know, what might have been if he played something more mellow and accessible.
I don't know. But, I mean, that's the conundrum, I guess, in some ways, especially with artistic geniuses, that somebody like Rahsaan, just because of how skilled he was on the instruments and his ability, his knowledge of and ability to play a variety of different genres, could have very easily just done whatever the successful mainstream jazz artists or soul artists were doing at that period of time. Could have very easily have done those things.
Yeah.
And when you hear some of his records, especially the records from the 1970s on Atlantic, you hear, you know, him play a variety of popular tunes, but it isn't simply just a jazzy rendition of these popular tunes. There are a variety of different layers. It's very much Rahsaan's version of it. And I think that that's one of the things that I certainly always really appreciated about him, and I feel like some people also kind of misunderstood that about him while he was playing too, was just that so much of all these different sounds where sometimes he's playing very – sometimes within the exact same song this happens. He's playing something that's really traditional kind of New Orleans Dixieland kind of style, and he moves to something that's much more kind of avant-garde and more free, and then to something that is like more gospel or really soulful. And it really, for me, always seemed like it was just about Rahsaan trying to communicate the sounds that he was feeling or that were in his mind that he dreamed about, as was the case, you know, just trying to do whatever he could to bring out that music.
And it's all very natural. I mean, everything, it's like you've seen the film, Michael, because you obviously know Rahsaan. But and all that's in the film. And the thing is, all that's really natural. You know, he can go from Dixieland to avant-garde, and it all makes sense because he, and as you also said before, you know, he was, he said it differently than I'm going to say it, but, you know, the point is he knew about the history of the music. He was in the present making his music, and he was also pushing it forward to the future. It's like, you know, with Rahsaan, and Steve Turay says this, it's all a continuum, you know, and he was able to draw on the past and bring it through to the present and kind of push it through to the future, and it all makes sense. It's really, it's amazing how it all just, like, is very synergistic with what he's doing.
Yeah. So with right now, it seems like we're kind of really at the beginning of what's going to go on with this film.
Yeah.
I think you had said it to me before the interview started that currently you don't have a distributor for the film.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the film premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas this year in March 2014. And it's played at a couple odd festivals since then. and it continues to. But and I usually show up at the screenings and talk and do a Q&A. And I always say, you know, it feels like, you know, we've finished something. We finished the film. It's out there. It's getting played. But it's also – it's really a beginning. You know, it's a beginning for the film. A, we don't have a distributor yet. There is some interest, but, you know, we really – we have needs.
Mm-hmm.
Need number one. We need a distributor. You know, other things we need is we still need a little bit of funding to clear some of the costs for – licensing the archives we're using. We've licensed a good amount. We've licensed it all for festival play. But, you know, we need a little bit of scratch. We need a distributor. And the other thing is Dorothan and Dorothan Kirk, Rossan's wife, widow, and, you know, Rory too. We are laying the groundwork for a biopic. We really want to do a biopic on Rossan, a narrative film. So we've been trying to engage people on that. Potentially, if we, you know, in our ideal world, we can find an executive producer who will want to kind of help us get that made, you know, somebody who has the wherewithal to push that through being made. Because as everything we've just been saying, I mean, the story is so incredible. It's like you can't make this stuff up. You can't write a better film.
It's almost an unbelievable story. When you try to tell it fully, it doesn't sound believable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, I think, part of the reason why it's needed. It's needed a film like this because, you know, expressing it in words or learning it through the records and liner notes and interviews and all of that is one way of certainly getting this story across. But you know, film is one of those mediums that really – I think the experience of seeing it, especially on a big screen or even when it's on the small screen in your home, like it's just – it's a very different kind of connection that people have. And so the documentary is certainly going to raise much more awareness, and hopefully, if nothing more, what it does is it does allow for the possibility of an even, you know, kind of larger project, some kind of biopic about Rossan, which would be – beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, right now I see that I want to get – obviously we want to get distribution for the documentary, but I also am using it ideally as a calling card to, you know, again, to get it in front of somebody and say, look, we make a biopic on this guy. And, you know, once they see the documentary, I think people will know the value. Again, you know, the other thing about the documentary – before I do that, so I just, you know – Rossan was all about engagement, as I said, and so are we with the film. So we like to be engaged with the audience. And therefore, if you want to engage with us, we would love to hear from you. info@rossanfilm.com, or the website is rossanfilm.com, and that's rahsaanfilm.com. And the email is info@rossanfilm.com. You know, and again, just – I get emails all the time from people who have seen the film – and just to hear people, either some, a lot of them have seen Rossan and they relate, you know, stories, stuff I haven't heard. One guy wrote that he was trapped in an elevator with Rossan, and Rossan pulled out a gun, which I believe. I'm sure he didn't mean it violently. He loved to get a rise out of people. Yeah. He was a mean practical joker, and there's some great stories. But so, you know, if you want to just tell me that too, you know, get in touch. But we've played to packed houses in film festivals. We've sold out. We sold out our premiere at New York. And everybody in that theater is engaged. And I always get people talking to me after the film. You know, I get people crying because it gets heavy at the end. But, you know, what I want to say is even if they're not jazz fans, and a lot of them are not, people are engaged. So I think, you know, people have to put down their kind of a priorities if they have any. And if they just come check it out, I think they are immediately, you know, they're transformed. They're kind of won over. I think Rossan will win you over. Unless your pulse, you know, unless you're not breathing, you're going to be won over.
Yeah, it's certainly a testament to his skill as an artist. And even though you didn't want to give yourself many kudos as well, I would imagine it also a testament to your skill as a filmmaker, because the story in some ways maybe it tells itself, but it still requires somebody to bring it all together.
Yeah,
and sure. And for that, you know, many of us who are longtime fans of Rossan are really eternally grateful for you for doing this project and
cool.
Making it happen.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I do think there were some hard things to do in the film, and there are some. A lot of places where it succeeds. I mean, for example, I had audio tape of him talking and stuff from live performances. Mm-hmm. Great audio stuff where he's joking and or you know, being political, or just, you know, he talked a lot, as we said. And then I thought, well, how am I going to cover it? What are we going to see visually? You know, film is a visual medium. And I didn't want to do kind of the slow pan into a photograph a la Ken Burns. You know, that's good for certain films if you're... Mm-hmm. So there was a challenge. There were many challenges in making the film. One was in what are we going to see visually? Because I knew I wanted to keep this audio, this great stuff of Rossan talking. So I tried a lot of stuff, but at the end of the day, I engaged another artist, an animator. There's animated segments in the film. The guy just nailed it, and I kissed a lot of toads before I got the guy here. But I think you'll agree when you see it, because the animation is kind of fitting with the times. I mean, one reviewer called it a mix between Yellow Submarine and Fat Albert.
Yeah.
So, which I think is accurate, and it just feels right. It feels right. And again, a lot of people got it wrong before then, so that's how I know this one's right. But you know, there were a lot of challenges making the film. You know, how are you gonna show this? How are you gonna tell the story of the Jazz and People's Movement? That was, you know, because Talking Heads only get you so far. But then again, the Talking Heads, it's an intimate film between the Super 8 footage, the home movie footage Dorthon gave me, and the interviews, because everyone. Like I said, they just loved him, and he's a type of person who changed lives.
Yeah,
everyone who knew him or even saw him, you know, they have a life changing story. He changed their lives, so it he was deep, and the film is pretty deep.
So we whenever there is a screening that's going to be here in Los Angeles, or we get word about a distribution deal, DVD release, any of those different things, you know, we'll definitely let you guys know out there, because I know there are a lot of fans of Rossan, Roland Kirk here in Los Angeles, and with the worldwide audience that we also get online. And all of them, again, just as I'm doing right now, just thank you so much for coming in today and talking about it, but especially for making this film.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I do want to mention, you know, we just screened in L.A., but we'll probably be back in L.A. in the winter. We'll probably be back in L.A. back in New York in the winter or the late fall. We're going to be in Amsterdam at the International Documentary Festival of Amsterdam in November, and we're going around the world. So, you know, again, the website gets updated pretty accurately, so that's rossanfilm.com, and you know, check in with us, send us a letter, send us a note, smoke signal. But thanks for having me. It was great.
Once again, the film about Rossan Roland Kirk that we've been talking about is called The Case of the Three-Sided Dream. You can find more information about it online at rossanfilm.com, rahsaanfilm.com. Going to leave you with some music from Rossan Roland Kirk right now. This comes from a record that he put out in 1965. It was recorded in front of an audience at the Lennox Studios, if my memory serves correctly, and features some of Rossan's personality, some of his sense of humor. You can certainly get a fair amount of that, many of the things that we were talking about during the interview. And this is something that features Rossan on a number of instruments, and also the audience helping along on whistles that were passed out to them. The name of the song and the album that it comes from are called Here Comes the Whistle Man, and you're hearing it right now on KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot.
You know, like I'll be snapping my fingers, me in the bass, don't blow the whistle then. But when I get it built up, where I get a climax built up in your mind, you know, when I come in on the saxophone and the spirit hits you, it's just like making love or something like that. Whenever you feel it, let it go. You know? This so you don't do it when we're whistling, because the whistle, when I'm whistling like that, that's supposed to go into like what we do every day in America. Whistle, you know, make things happen, pretend like we happen. So, you know, whistle while we work. Yeah. So we can get it on the top 40 stations. I would appreciate it very much if you helped me do this, because, you know. So, you ready to record this, brother? Hey, Joe, when you get here, man?
I just got here. There was an unbelievable accident on the turnpike. We were stuck for 3 hours about 2 miles out of New York.
You should have let me drive you up here. I would have got you up here all right. Okay.
Okay, you're ready. Take one.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this next composition, we call this Here Comes the Whistle Man. And when the spirits hit you, we want you to blow your whistle instead of thinking about blowing your brains out. Just take your whistle in your hand and blow your whistle, and I'm sure you will feel a message from this. This is called Here Comes the Whistle Man.